July brings about new life in the ED and a fourth year, that's right, 4 years of AZMCast. Why do we keep doing this, you may ask? Because no one has told us to stop yet. Welcome, new interns near and far, to Arizona MCAST, a hastily thrown together podcast from the University of Arizona Department of Emergency Medicine. For those of you new to the podcast, we try to tackle a singular EM topic each month with a mix of opinion and evidence to give you the best knowledge we can going into your next shift. How is this different from every other podcast, you may ask? Well, it's not. At least not in content. No, we at AZMCast are firmly convinced that we do not know everything there is to know about EM, and that much out there on the blogosphere is opinion and conjecture. So we try to back up our opinion with evidence, which you will be cued to with a bell ding. And when we're blowing smoke like the flock of turkeys that we are, we admit it. And to prove it even further, we invite EM docs from outside of our little ivory tower of academia to give our show a peer review before it gets sent off to you, the listener. And we're fortunate to have Peter Rosen. So for this month, put your head between your legs, grab your nearest trash can as we discuss the wonderful and very timely world of vomit. The end of another academic year and the start of blistering heat here in Tucson, Arizona. 118 last weekend. Did you go outside?
I did for 4 seconds.
Why?
Because I could. I wanted to experience it.
I burnt my hand on the air just coming out inside. I waved it at my neighbor and I burned my hand.
That's not good.
No, it was really hot out. So it's the end of an academic year, and we're saying goodbye to another group of seniors. We're going to be starting with a brand new crop of interns who, if you're listening to this right now, shut it off and go read a book, okay? We've already covered this before, but this is kind of a supplement to after you've already had a good foundation, and it's not even that great of a supplement to your foundational knowledge, so probably you're better off reading a book.
Yeah, I think it's good for driving to and from work when you just want to clear your head and not think about anything.
However, it's gotten a whole lot better because we've added, in addition to Brian and I, we have Dan Jarrell, who is one of our ED pharmacists, who is joining us. Hi, Dan.
Hi, thanks for inviting me.
So we're very excited to have somebody who knows what they're talking about here as well. For those of you that may be from places where you didn't have an ED pharmacist, I don't know how you functioned. You might as well not have internet or running water. It's fantastic to have an ED pharmacist when you say, I need prothrombin complex concentrate, but I don't know how to spell it or what the dose is, and it's in your hand because Dan has already foreseen that you needed it and it's ready. So thank you for what you do clinically.
Oh, absolutely.
It's wonderful.
Absolutely wonderful to have them.
So today what we're going to discuss is the bane of summer, which is gastroenteritis. We're going to discuss vomiting and nausea and how to get it under control so that people can go on with their daily lives. Have you guys got the bug yet this summer?
Our family had it April, but it was just more runs than things coming up.
Oh, that's good. That's good.
Luckily, I haven't had any problem.
There's still time left in the summer. We've been seeing a lot of puking, and I tell this to parents a lot of... This is the time of year where viruses turn from cough, cold, runny nose, influenza, to all manner of stuff that usually involves some kind of vomiting or diarrhea or rash, or if you're really unlucky, some kind of weird nerve palsy or strange things that summertime viruses do. So summer, you never know what you're going to get. But we're going to talk a little bit about gastroenteritis, and I'd like to lead off with something that I usually tell my interns, which is you can't have gastroenteritis without gastritis and enteritis. So we have lots of kids that come in vomiting. And the most common thing being common, they end up having some kind of a virus, some kind of a viral-borne infection, maybe a food-borne illness. Is it stomach flu, doc, or is it food poisoning? I don't know. You're puking. Here's some medication. We hope you feel better. But if when they just come in with vomiting, it makes me a bit nervous because there are other things that will cause vomiting. And this is the time of year when we see something like brain tumors or DKA or UTIs present to the ER with repeated episodes of vomiting that has been chalked up to a virus. Have you seen some of these bounce back the second or third time, Brian?
Oh, it's common. And it's hard to, you can't really pick it up the first time, even if you wanted to. I mean, if the only symptom that the patients complain of is vomiting and you can't get anything else out of them, you treat them for just the vomiting. And you tell them, most likely it's a virus, could be something else. You get another symptom, you get something that changes, come on back.
I love the return precautions for these because vomiting is one of those weird things that they come back and guess what? It's appendicitis because their belly has changed. So you say, you got to come back if your belly pain changes or gets worse. You have to come back if your child is acting funny, they're stumbling over things to when you think of a brain tumor. You have to come back if they start peeing like crazy, even though they're not really keeping much down, to think about DKA. For me, especially for DKA, or really just for gastroenteritis in general, a finger stick goes a long way. It's a cheap, easy test. It's a little bit invasive, just enough to make mom and dad feel like you've done something for their child, rather than give them a $150 Otter Pop.
Yeah, I think a D-stick's easy, and if you're still not concerned, maybe it's the adult patient and they're a diabetic, and they usually have sugars that are running high, and they're high because of the illness, just get a quick venous gas, and if the pH is fine and their glucose seems under control, probably not DKA. You can't definitively without a bicarb level, but you know, it's a pretty good quick screen on these patients, and while you're getting the fluids and getting their symptoms under control, you can quickly address those and knock it out. Same thing, like you can get a quick point of care pregnancy if you're, you know, a young lady's coming in with just vomiting, maybe that's what's going on. So you have all these different causes of vomiting, and that's why it's such a hard differential, and you need a good history and a good exam and just a really good review of systems.
Yeah, trying to pick out some of those slight underliers that, you know, now that you think of it, I haven't had a period in 2 months, and my breasts feel full. I mean, that's literally one that I had on Saturday. I go, I think I know what's going on, and you could have solved this problem with an EPT at Walgreens. By the way, I'm going to be saying a lot of brand names talking about gastroenteritis, so I can't help but use the Z word when talking about gastroenteritis. I will say Zofran, I will say vitamin Z, I will say God's gift to emergency doctors. That's how I will refer to it, because I can't say Ondansetron?
Ondansetron.
All right, but I won't say it. Okay. It's such a fun word to say.
Zo and go. I've never heard of Zo.
You've never heard Zo and go? No. Yeah, that's the usually assessment and plan. So Zo and go, that's correct. one thing I did want to harp on is the brain tumor, because that's something that we will see from time to time, and it is tough to pick up. You don't want to CAT scan every kid that's puking, but there are some criteria that you can look into. One thing is if they've got headache associated with it, especially if they're less than two, really less than maybe even four. I mean, a two-year-old should not complain of a headache, so that always makes me a little bit worried. If they've got gait instability, that makes me concerned. By the time they've got a focal neurologic change, most people will be able to pick that up, but that might be the second or third visit. So headache greater than a month is one of the criteria that's suggested for getting advanced imaging in a kid that's vomiting, or if they've had vomiting for greater than 2 weeks. These are people to consider getting a head CT on, and that was actually published in a great paper where neurosurgeons said this is what pediatricians should know about imaging for brain tumors. So.
Yeah, I think, you know, you're differentiating, too. If the patient's just vomiting, or even if they're vomiting and diarrhea, that still doesn't always mean that it's a viral illness. I mean, we're also in summertime. People like mayonnaise, and people like hot mayonnaise. And so then they get bacterial infections, and you can have a bacterial enteritis or a viral enteritis. The symptoms are going to be similar. But other things, even with vomiting and diarrhea, a bowel obstruction can present with that. So you need to ask a surgical history. So I think what Aaron's really trying to say is keeping your differential broad on these patients. Yes, most likely, if you had to roll the dice on all of them, they're going to be a virus or something that we will never discover but will go away and be self-limited. But at the same time, you've got to think of these other things. And as long as you're doing that thought process and you're investigating when you think you need to and given good return precautions, you're going to be fine.
And for those of you outside of Tucson, Google Sonoran hot dog and understand why we see so much gastroenteritis here in Tucson. So
totally worth it.
So, all right. So now we've decided clinically you don't have a brain tumor. You don't have DKA. We're done fear-mongering. You clinically have gastroenteritis. So with these patients, we need to get them to stop throwing up. And what we used to do, especially for kids, we don't like poking kids if we don't have to. So we would try to do the PO challenge, which I usually tell residents, if you were going to put an IV in this kid, how much would you give them as a bolus? Well, 20 per kilo. Great. Then give them 20 per kilo orally. Take their weight, measure it out, say this is how much you have to drink over the next hour, which is the same as a bolus. And that gives you an idea of what they need to do. Similarly, they need to drink maintenance fluids. So that 4-2-1 rule that you may have learned in medical school that you may have thought you can forget, it's actually very useful to tell parents, when you can't tell what in a diaper is pee and what is poop, and you can't tell how many wet diapers they're having to monitor their urine output, here's an idea of maintenance fluids. You know, it's your child would need approximately 30 mLs per ounce. So your child would need 2 ounces an hour over 24 hours. But since no kid drinks 24 hours a day, how about we call it 4 ounces in 12 hours? And that'll be enough for your fluids for the day. It's a little bit of math camp, but I think as a parent, it helps me to know this is how much my child needs to get in. And at that point, I'm doing a good enough job. I just got to wait for the symptoms to go away.
Yeah, I think you ought. The difference with kids and adults in this, I tend to do less IV fluids in, say, a child. Most of them do very well with Zo and Go, or just even getting an Otter Pop. They're still able to keep fluids down. They're going to still puke. They're still going to have some diarrhea, but they're going to get rehydrated. And you've addressed mom and dad's concern. In adults, I end up giving a little bit more IV fluids because I can get them better faster with that than telling the adult, oh, here's your Otter Pop, and sorry, it's not a beer, but you have to drink this, and oh, you only can drink a little bit at a time. Adults aren't really, give me the fluids, give me the sweato, you know, this is what I want, and I'll get better. But I agree, I think they still have to take oral liquids either way when they're going home. They're going to have to, so get on top of it in the ER, but at the same time, you don't have to hold them indefinitely waiting for those oral liquids. If you give good instructions with mom and dad or the patient, and you're just going to do oral liquids on them, not a problem. Just give them the oral liquids, let them go home. If they fail, have them come on back.
One of our pediatricians has a sign up in his office that says, your child does not need juice. That's all it says. Because juice is really just sugar and water. We try to pretend that it's healthy, but it's sugar water. But you know what? As an ER doctor, I say your child is allowed to have juice. They can have water, they can have juice, they can have some kind of electrolyte solution for their age group. They can have popsicles. They can have EGs, which, again, those of you not from Tucson, Google EGs and then come down and have some EGs. It is frozen sugar and water, which is exactly what every sick child needs to keep their sugar up, to keep their volume status up. I find that keeps a lot of kids out of the ER with IVs and their anticubes. We talked about the sugar for making sure it's not DKA. You also want a sugar to make sure it's not too low. It's a really easy thing to check, and giving them some sugar, they will bounce back in a heartbeat. It's really, really nice to see.
Yeah, I think letting these kids go with any liquid that they've already consumed before. If the child has never had Gatorade or a juice of some kind, I don't tell the parents to, now that they're sick, introduce that juice so that they'll have an aversion for the rest of their life. But if it's water, milk, juice, you know, popsicles, totally good. I think popsicles, anything cold is good because the kids can't down it fast, so it slows their hydration process and, you know, stops them from having that big gulp of some liquid that they down in 30 seconds, which is 5 times their stomach, and then it starts the puke factory again.
Yeah, it helps. It forces them to pace themselves.
Correct.
So we used to say, all right, you've done your PO challenge, you've failed, time for the IV. However, modern medicine has injected step number 2, which is the antiemetic, and that is why we have Dan here. It's because we're going to be asking him about some of the antiemetics of choice for children, for adults, and kind of, you know, what the thresholds are for using these. For me, I use ondansetron, Zofran, for pretty much
everybody. I can't think of many people that I don't give Zofran to if they say that they've thrown up or they've thought about throwing up or they saw on TV somebody else throw up and it made them queasy. I pretty much give them Zofran.
Yeah, and I think one of the questions that we're trying to address here and that is tough in the ED is you're talking about oral rehydration therapy, trying to avoid IV rehydration therapy. When do you initiate oral on danzatron versus IV on danzatron? And so I think that's also something that we have to deal with in the ED, trialing that before we move on to the IV for symptom management.
I think the answer for that, as soon as they write that V on their check-in sheet of paper for vomiting, they should be immediately given oral on danzatron in the waiting room.
This is part of the choosing wisely guidelines that ASEP wanted to push is, you know, if you can hydrate somebody orally, do it orally instead of IVs. You don't have to overpoke these kids or even these adults. Some adults just need some oral rehydration, and you give them that magic pill, and it makes them feel better. And I sell it, man. I love this medication. I've got a bottle of it at home. I take it when I feel sick. I give it to my kids when they feel sick. I give it to my dog when she gets sick. I don't actually do that because I don't know if that's safe. I aerosolize it in my car. It comes out of my muffler. I mean, I love this medication. It should be in the water supply. And I really sell it, and a lot of that helps them feel better as well. So, Dan, we got a couple formulations to choose from for Zofran, right?
Yeah, so we've got the tablet form. There's also an orally disintegrating form, which might be a little bit more easier for your smaller children to take. And we've also got an oral solution, and then we also have an intravenous form. So there's a lot of forms to choose from, and I think, you know, age, how well are they tolerating oral rehydration therapy, how do they do with medications that might not be very palatable, might dictate which one of those you're going to choose.
So I think most people like to start with that second line after Zofran. What do you go for?
I think in a child or an adult?
In a child and in an adult.
Boy, in a child, sugar is probably my best, trying to stop their ketosis. I don't, if it's an older child, I'll use metoclopramide. If it is a, or compazine, I'll use, I forgot, that's like promethazine or
prochlorperazine.
Yeah, that's exactly why you're here, Dan.
That's why I don't say that one, so I'll mess it up. But, I remember we used to give Tigan suppositories. I have not done that in a long time in children. Maybe Dan can explain.
And I have not seen that in the emergency department either. So I know it's a therapy historically that people have used, but I really don't see that anymore.
Yeah, I have not used that in a while. Most kids do really well with Zofran. And if they're failing that in some oral liquids, they're going to get an IV and we're in a different ball game. And then, to be honest, after some IV fluids, most of those kids perk up. I think adults are a little bit different. They're almost harder to treat.
I do exactly the same thing. I have a three-step process. I say, we're going to give you some of the anti-nausea medicine, give it about 20 minutes, and then try to drink. And if they throw up again, they're going to get an IV, and we're going to give them some fluids as a bolus, and then we'll try to get them to drink again. And if they throw up again, and they really can't keep stuff down, they're not keeping that fluid down, we're going to keep you in the hospital. What about for adults?
I think adults, I'm pretty aggressive with my meds.
Yes,
there's a lot of cocktails that I like to use. So in adults, I will actually use either metoclopramide or compazine, depending on what's in the Pyxis. And so that's, and sometimes I give that at the same time as the ondansetron. Why? They're a little different mechanisms, and I'm trying to get an effect faster as well as some fluids going in. So to me, the more mechanisms I can hit at the same time, and the sooner I can get that adult better faster, the sooner they get to go home and on with their life, and they're not sitting puking, getting other people infected. So that's probably my second line. And my 2A used to be droperidol. And I won't get into the bad stuff about what Zofran did to droperidol, and that's a whole nother sub-story. You could read about that online if you'd like. But droperidol we haven't had for a while, so I have their little cousin, Haldol, which I give to a lot of my patients, as Dan is nodding here and just shaking his head. But I think Haldol works really well. A lot of these people have cramping pain, and droperidol is probably was my number one antiemetic in adults that I used for a long time, and it was great. It worked in the anesthesia patients, it worked in the ER patients, it worked for everybody. You get a little crampy pain or a little abdominal pain, it helped that out too. They had a headache, it helped that out. It's a great drug. And then the other thing I do is, if these patients have been not eating anything for a while, I give most of these patients D5 normal saline as my bolus. Why am I doing that? I'm doing that because I believe if after a certain period of time, maybe 8 hours, 12 hours, you haven't eaten anything, you're starting to get a little ketotic. The ketones now are making you more nauseous and want you to vomit more. So even if I take care of your brain kind of brain mechanisms for your antiemetic properties, I still am not clearing the ketones, which are going to continue. So if I give them a little sugar, stops the ketosis, I'm hydrating them at the same time, I'm not worrying about them eating in the next few hours, and I can get them home faster. So that's probably my first four. I rarely use Phenergan unless the patient asks for it. Why? Because patients seem to not like the way Phenergan makes them feel.
Oh, man. We have different patients that we see. Well, my patients love their Phenergan along with their Benadryl pushed really fast in the same syringe. Well, that takes away my nausea every time.
If they ask for it, they get it. Because that's, right, they know that effect. But normal people don't like that effect. They, you know, they're like, I don't feel well. And I forgot to mention, I give diphenhydramine to just about every patient. I think it's a great drug.
Ankle sprain, stroke, yeah. Doesn't matter.
And I believe the Canadians are big anti-cholinergic, and they love diphenhydramine for nausea.
If I ever meet a Canadian, I'll ask one.
But this, you know, in the studies, we talk about all the studies for these. And the studies for most of these antiemetics don't show huge benefits. I mean, even the Zofran for gastroenteritis in the ER in the initial studies definitely show benefits and trends. But part of that, you know, people worry, is it the placebo effect of it? Is it the IV fluids that you gave with the antiemetic that's making the patient feel better? You know, what is the actual mechanism of them truly? Because they're never like, oh my gosh, they all stop vomiting immediately from the drug. And I agree, Aaron, it is a wonderful drug and I use it all the time. But you want the studies to all say, like, it stopped vomiting completely. And I think that's a misnomer when we tell our patients. I tell them, if you're vomiting 5 times a day, maybe I can take it to 2 or 3 times a day. Or your diarrhea, we're going to try to slow that down a little bit. But I try not to tell them it's going away. Because then, like, I went home and I vomited. You know, Johnny vomited one more time when he went home. Oh my gosh, I brought him back. No, that's okay. That's the process of the disease. But we slowed it down. Now Johnny's hydrated. He's still playing, even though he's vomiting.
So, Dan, I was going to ask you, it seems like many of these antiemetics have this sedative and maybe even euphoric kind of quality. How much of it do you think is actual antiemetic? It actually acts in the stomach and stops the area of nausea, or acts in the brain and stops the area of nausea, versus patients just don't care as much anymore.
I think you bring up a good point. Most of them are going to have some sedative properties, and as we know, you make someone less anxious, calm them down. That really helps with a lot of different symptoms, you know, pain being one, and probably nausea and the urge to vomit. But we do know that there's a ton of receptors in the brain, the chemoreceptor trigger zone, that these drugs are probably having an effect on. It's probably tough to tease out what that specific, you know, role is, but we do know that there is some stuff going on in the brain. And I think a lot of that also comes down to looking at the literature for cancer patients in chemo, and we're looking at all of these high doses of antiemetics working on these different parts of the brain for different regimens that have different potential for emetogenicity. So I do think there is a role in the brain, but I do think, you know, making your patient a little sleepy and feeling good is probably not a bad idea either.
So what about the patients that say, you know, for instance, oh, you know, I get really nauseous whenever I get pain meds. You know, I need something for my pain because I got abdominal pain. We're going to give you morphine. Ah, I don't know. That always makes me nauseous. Or, you know, I don't know if I've ever been nauseous with morphine before. Do those patients benefit from getting Zofran, from getting any kind of antiemetic to go along with it as a chaser?
There is a ton of literature looking at this. Now, for our ED patients, not as much literature as there is for, you know, your post-op patients or patients that get intrathecal medications or PCA medications. There is some evidence for those situations. But for our ED patients getting opioids in the ED for whatever pain they're having, there is some trials, most of them looking at Reglan for these patients. But many of them really don't show any difference. And surprisingly, some of them actually show higher rates of nausea and vomiting when you give them the antiemetic. So I don't know if that's, you know, changing what the opioids are doing in the gut, making them more likely to be nauseous. But really, there's nothing that's come out and said this is the savior of opioid-induced nausea and vomiting. And the rates of nausea and vomiting from opioids are low to begin with. So I think we're searching for something that doesn't happen as much as we think it does.
The only one I thought had a little bit was morphine has more of a histamine release. So if you give a little Benadryl, sometimes that can stop the nausea with the histamine release from that. And I know that certain groups have done that with their high-dose pain. You know, they're given a 0.1 mg per kg of morphine, and so they give 25 of Benadryl, say, at the same time to help prevent that, trying to prevent a nausea-related that they may not see as much with fentanyl or hydromorphone.
And I agree with that. I don't know of any data that comes out and says that, but mechanistically, it makes some sense. So I think that's reasonable to try. I think it's more likely to help than some of these other agents working in totally different areas that the opioids probably aren't influencing. So I think if you're going to try something, you know, Benadryl is usually pretty benign, except for you're really old or your stroke patient, something like that. But I think that's reasonable to do in those patients.
And I think that also goes not just morphine, but any of the more natural opiates as opposed to more of the synthetic opiates. Usually the synthetic ones have less nausea, vomiting associated with them in general. Is that true, or is that just wives' tale?
No, that's absolutely true. Fentanyl is the classic one that does not have any histamine release, but then your others, morphine being the one that's classically taught as having the most histamine release. Hydromorphone has some. And then your oral ones, since we're not giving them IV, they may have some histamine release, but it doesn't appear to be as potent as your IV formulations. Yeah.
Quinine's not a real drug.
It's
like Ipecac in a pill.
We should take that off the market. It is terrible.
It should go away.
All right, so I always love when everything I learned in medical school fails me. So all the antiemetics, you know, try to give it for opiate-induced vomiting or nausea, and find some of them that actually make it worse. It's like, great, you know, what are we doing? We're just trying to figure this up. This is why we call them cocktails. I don't know, here's what I like. I like to use this. No, I like to use that one. I have found good luck with patients if they are really having bad pukes. With Compazine suppositories. Compazine IV, I have given Compazine IV once, and the patient kind of crawled up the wall like that baby in Train Spotting. The akesthesias, and just they felt absolutely terrible. So I've done two things. So I don't give it IV push anymore. I put it in a bag of saline and let it run in over an hour so they still get the medication. Consequently, I do that with my 1 mg Dilaudid that I promised some of my patients as well. But I've also told the patients, look, we're going to get you feeling as best as we can. I can't promise I'll take it all away, but I'm going to make it manageable. And I'm going to give you a prescription for these suppositories. Do you know what a suppository is? And they shake their head, no. And I say, if it's really that bad, you will use this, and it will likely make you feel better. And a few patients have said, man, that was really, really helpful when it came down to it. But yeah, I didn't want to use it at all. It's helpful.
Yeah, I think the putting it in the bag is a great idea. I know with metoclopramide, I learned that same trick from a nurse a few years ago. You put it in the bag because it's really, and some studies have shown this, but the rates of extrapyramidal side effects are much higher the faster it's given. So you're not going to get that liter in 1 minute. So you put it in the liter and just slowing the infusion, I think over greater than 15 minutes for like metoclopramide, drop the, in the one study, from like 25% to 6% rate of anticholinergic effects just from slowing it down. So I think that's a great idea, Aaron.
So kind of going from our bag of pharmacy tricks to other tricks that people use. I mean, distractions, great in kids. Giving sugar, it's cheap, easy to do. And one of our nurses actually sent me an article about using inhaled isopropyl alcohol to stop nausea, which was fascinating. And this is all over the web now of people trying to use this. I mean, whoever came up with this is like, I don't know, just make them go huff some isopropyl alcohol and we'll see what it worked. Oh man, we should write this up. I mean, that was pretty impressive. You said you were going to start doing this, right?
Yeah, I'm going to start doing this. It was interesting. I had just heard about it when Aaron sent the email, but I'd heard, I think, a week before on one of the podcasts I listened to on EM Abstracts, they had covered an article on it. This is actually, so I was doing some looking into it. It's been in the anesthesia literature for a while, and a lot of the post-op literature. So it's part of post-op management for anesthetics. So there's actually some good nursing articles on this, and there's still some ER studies out now, and there's another one, I think, at Brooke Army Medical Center on clinicaltrials.gov. And I think this is pretty easy. It seems to be very fast, and even before you get, you may have to repeat it. That's what it seems. Maybe it lasts 10, 15 minutes, and maybe you have to repeat it, but you have a lot of alcohol pads, or you can even get a whole bottle of isopropyl alcohol and start shaking it and letting people take a whiff off it if you want. But if you're in, you know, triage, you know, a nurse is going to clean their stethoscope anyway. Here, open it, take a whiff. I see you're vomiting. I just gave you a bucket. Now I'll clean my stethoscope because I touched you and I don't want this. And so you can see that. And if it works for 10 minutes and they don't puke till they get their IV, great. And to be honest, it's cheap. It's easy. The downsides, I don't know much. I mean, a couple brain cells die, maybe.
I don't think it's like sniffing glue.
I don't think sniffing glue. I think it's a good experience.
Don't get it mixed up with your ammonia packets, you know. So, I mean, there are plenty of creative ways to do this, to try to get through. I usually just tell patients to eat or drink small amounts over the course of time. They don't need to take a whole lot in at once. I have not tried isopropyl alcohol, but I'm going to try it on myself first, I think, the next time I get sick to my stomach, which I have my next PED shift on tomorrow. So there's a good chance that I'll be using it this weekend.
Yes.
There's also, you know, another method, the Bear Grylls method of giving yourself an enema in order to rehydrate yourself. I can't say I've ever gone that route with a patient. I've never been that aggressive. However, there are other routes of being able to rehydrate patients, especially kids. There's a lot of pediatric literature about using NG tubes. If you can't get the IV because their veins are so collapsed, you can throw an NG tube down and give them boluses through the NG, assuming they don't puke because there's a giant tube down their nose. But probably one of the more fascinating ones, the high hyaluronidase and injecting the fluid sub-Q, giving them the Quasimodo look. Have you ever seen that, Dan?
I haven't seen it in the ED. I've seen a lot of animals with it. I know they do that in the veterinary medicine. But I have heard of a few times in our emergency department it happening, but I have not personally seen it.
I have offered it twice to two children. One mom accepted and then declined, and the other one declined. I think the idea, it was also, it's in the palliative literature too, and palliative patients on hospice or whatnot, they just want some hydration for comfort. They'll do this and put a butterfly needle, you know, in each thigh, in the middle of the back, different places. And you can put, in the studies with the hyaluronidase, I think the company companies pushing the hyaluronidase, I think it showed maybe a little bit easier, but it's not a significant, you can do it with or without. I don't think it's mandatory to give the hyaluronidase, but the thought is that it may help open up the fascial planes and make it easier and less painful for the infusion to go in. But in most, in a normal sized adult, you can give about 250 cc's in every
pocket
that you place, and it's supposed to work reasonably well. And I know in the animals, I've seen it done before. When we were in Iraq, we did that for animals because they were getting dry and whatnot. So I think it's reasonable, but I don't think many people offer it. I've done the NG tube once, and someone told me how to do that, and I thought that was crazy. Like, I'm going to go after this 18-month-old with an NG tube, and they actually sat and took it, and it worked well, but it just seems, like you said, a little invasive.
Well, and we don't think an IV is invasive because we do them all day long, and parents don't think IVs are invasive. In fact, I usually have to talk a lot of parents out of the IV. My pediatrician, the urgent care, sent me here to get an IV. Well, let's talk about some other stuff that we have available before we go to poking. But, you know, NG tube is a viable option. The hyaluronidase, I think, definitely helps alleviate the pain associated with an extravasated IV, which is essentially what you're dealing with. All that fluid gets absorbed eventually, but you don't want an IV that extravasates is very painful. So if you can minimize that with the hyaluronidase, it's very helpful. You like how I can say hyaluronidase, but not ondansetron?
I like that. I'd like you to hear the, what's the trade name for hyaluronidase?
Probably really easy to say.
So. I have no idea.
I love that. There are a lot of these drug names. I swear they're just making them up so that you can't say them, so that you have to use the brand name. So anyway, that's just my opinion. But I think the biggest barrier to me when I've talked about it with parents is parents are uncomfortable with this convention. Because what you would do is you would load up a bolus in between the kid's shoulder blades and send them home, because it's going to take hours to absorb. And most parents are just not comfortable with that. At least the parents that I've talked to when I've offered it and said, here's another option, they were like, no, we're not doing your crazy experimental medicine, or archaic. It's either experimental or archaic.
I don't think it's normally done, and so parents, whether it may be better than anything else we do, but no one wants it because, you know, Sally didn't have that, and Missy didn't have that, so why is Johnny getting it? I don't understand, doctor. You're crazy.
So to kind of round out, what do you do with those patients, and this is definitely more common in the adults, the intractable nausea and vomiting? Doctor, you just don't understand. I can't keep anything down. I really need to be admitted.
Well, they're going to get a cocktail, first and foremost. And I think, are you heading towards the ones that come back on a regular basis for their intractable, or just the first time this is so bad? Because I think those are two different patients.
The patient that comes in and is legitimately puking their guts out, and they've got three emesis basins scattered everywhere, they've never been up in your system once, those are patients that probably aren't going to do well. You're going to check their lights, and their K is going to be 1, and their bicarb's going to be 4, and you probably need to come into the hospital. It's the ones that say, they keep spitting into the bucket, and they stick their finger down the back of their throat because it makes them feel better, but there's never actually any vomit that comes out.
Right.
Is that where you would suggest some lorazepam, Dr. Cheryl?
Potentially, yeah. It has some antiemetic properties.
Is that, again, because it just sedates them and they feel better about their life?
Probably in these patients, absolutely. But in the chemo literature, definitely for the anticipatory nausea and vomiting, it definitely has a role. So it probably is doing something there, too.
Yeah, I think these people are getting a cocktail. So now I know where you're going, Aaron. These people are going to get the kitchen sink, and I will give them 2 liters of D5 normal saline, and I'll bolus that. They're going to get Zofran, Reglan, diphenhydramine, Haldol, and they're probably going to get a low dose of some opiate, just because I'm sure they're having cramping, and also to make them feel good. And so I'm going to have given them all that. I sometimes will throw Zantac or some H2 blocker as well as magnesium at them. And I'm going to try to relax that gut and get him as feeling as good as possible. And if it doesn't work, and I say I have given 7 medicines, then I will turn to my internal medicine colleagues and say, you know, I have given a lot of medicines to this patient, and I just don't think that they are benefiting from an outpatient therapy. I think they'd benefit from an inpatient therapy, and you're a great doctor, and I know you can take care of this. But I think benzos are reasonable in these patients. I have also considered low-dose ketamine in these patients, depending on how goofy they are and what I really think is going on. I haven't given it much, but you know, when you're at 7-8 medicines in an hour or 2 hours, I think that's a pretty good swing.
Just to kind of recap, we've talked about a lot of different medication therapies. There's a lot of evidence about lots of these medications we've tried, and there's not a lot of evidence about several of these medications that we've tried, that we've discussed trying. So keep in mind that a lot of this is a cocktail. I mean, we just talked about how you look through the literature and some of this stuff works and some of it makes you feel worse. And it's very patient dependent. This will probably be something when we start doing like genomic directed therapy. We're going to go, you look like a metoclopramide patient and you look like a prochlorperazine patient based on your DNA. But this is a cocktail, and I think people find stuff that they like and they stick with it and maybe alter it a little bit here and there to try something new. But I think people develop their cocktails probably during residency, right?
Right. And I think even your first few years out as an attending, you'll change up, because sometimes in residency you're directed, you have to do this because your attending wants you to do this. And you're like, I don't want to do this, but you have to do this. So I think you do try these cocktails, and I try to tailor it really patient specific, because you kind of see that, you know, there might maybe my Bermuda Triangle patient. What? They have fibromyalgia and gastroparesis and 20 allergies to medicines. And, you know, they're a Bermuda Triangle. They're going to be a troublemaker no matter what. They're going to get more medicines than, say, someone who's maybe a hyperemesis patient because they have bad diabetes and are just gastroparetic and they get hyperemesis all the time, versus someone who's intermittently just dehydrated on a regular basis and has about 2 episodes a year where they get really bad and come in. So, you know, I try to tweak it and give more or less meds that I think will benefit based on what their mechanism is that's really causing their vomiting.
I agree completely. When you guys give me a call and ask, hey, what should I do for this patient's nausea and vomiting, the first thing I'm going to ask you is, why do you think they're having these symptoms? Trying to get at that underlying cause, that differential. And we do know certain diseases are going to benefit from certain therapies over others. So I think keeping that in the back of your mind, trying to figure out what is the underlying cause, and that should dictate the therapy that you choose. There's one more thing I wanted to mention. So your intractable nausea, vomiting patient, one thing that I think you might get exposed to during your residency, and some of our physicians have already seen this, but I think with recent legislature, with the legalization of marijuana, you might start seeing a lot more cannabinoid hyperemesis syndrome. And those are very difficult to treat, and you usually go through all of your cocktails and are stuck and don't know what else to do. What you're probably going to see, I think, in the next couple of years is some papers on using capsaicin creams for those. There's a case series that was published about a year ago of 8 patients where they gave capsaicin across the trunk of the body and had very profound symptomatic relief. Really, the only benefit that you can get from this disease is stopping the cannabis. And it's kind of counterintuitive, because a lot of people are taking cannabis because it's an antiemetic. So it ends up being this cyclical thing that just doesn't go away. And one of the key parts in the history that might tip you off to this is they take a lot of hot showers or hot baths, and that seems to be the only thing that helps them. So it looks like there might be some heat-related receptor that's involved in this pathway, this mechanism, and that's where capsaicin comes into play and where we're seeing these people trying it on patients.
It sounds like such a stoner myth. Like, hey, man, the only way to stop this is to stop smoking weed. Nah, man, you just want me to quit smoking weed. There's no way. You're trying to get me in messing with my mind. I see where you're going with this.
Yeah, I think it's a balance, it seems like, because it's the heavy doses of marijuana seems to be the patients that are getting it. It's not necessarily right away. It seems a couple days. There's a little day lag. But I don't know if it's more the medicinal or people are just the ones who are using it heavy on a regular basis.
Yeah, and the literature that's out there, it appears to be chronic users, very long-term users, so those that are going to be difficult to get to stop. But they seem to be the ones that develop this type of syndrome. But just something to look out for because it is so treatment resistant.
I think another special circumstance would be hyperemesis in pregnancy. So if we see this, nausea, vomiting, and you talk to your first trimester pregnant women about how they can manage that as well. There's been maybe some studies or worry in the lay media about Zofran use or other use of antiemetics for pregnancy and whether it's going to cause birth defects or other problems. But dietary modifications. So sometimes, like Aaron was mentioning before, for anyone nausea, vomiting, small meals, frequent meals, having a little something in their stomach is an easy thing to do. Nothing that's distending the stomach when you already have an upset stomach seems to help. Some of the women also benefit from either just crackers or carbohydrates. Some do better with protein. So I think dietary is the first thing. And then now we're starting to see more of a use of B6 and doxylamine use. And this has been around for a long time. So if you want to Google a quick story, you could look at Bendectin.com. And there's a story because this drug has been around since the 50s. And it's a fascinating where it was lumped in with thalidomide. And then thalidomide was found to be bad because we caused seal babies. And so the same person who called out thalidomide then came back and came after Bendectin, which is also B6 and doxylamine. And so when this happened, no drug company made Bendectin anymore. The FDA never took it off the market. The FDA, this is the only level A recommended drug, I believe, for nausea, vomiting, and pregnancy. And so it didn't start up again until about, I think, 2013, and Diclectin came out in Canada, and now Diclegis is the trade name for the medicine. But you can make this over the counter, and so we offer our patients just B6 as well as Unisom is the over-the-counter way to get doxylamine, so they can get those over-the-counter. That's a safe thing that you can treat your hyperemesis patients, both going home or even in the emergency room if you want to. I believe metoclopramide, since we're on pregnancy antiemetics, is B. And Compazine, I believe, is also B. And I'm not sure about Phenergan. I don't think Zofran, I think, are both C. Magnesium, I think, maybe B in the, or maybe it's C or D because it can cause problems, but I don't think it hurts too much in the first. But I know you have now A, you could use B6 and doxylamine, and then for a B category, you could use Reglan in these patients. And I also give them D5 normal saline as well. If they haven't been eating for a long period of time, and some of these hyperemesis, you've probably seen them come in with a PICC line because they are so dehydrated and such a bad nausea, vomiting. And these can also, like your hyperemesis from cannabinoids, can be very difficult to control.
Great story, Hansel.
You can tell everybody. Yeah, you can tell everybody. Go ahead and tell everybody. I'm the man, I'm the man, I'm the man. Yes, I am, yes, I am, yes, I am. I'm the man.
So as I've mentioned before, we have lots of great guests that we're able to get on the podcast, but talking with Dr. Peter Rosen is certainly a special treat. He has the longevity and just a great keen insight into emergency medicine. So getting to pick his brain for Rosenisms is a lot of fun for me, and hopefully it's beneficial for you as well. This month I picked out a conversation that we had regarding having a high suspicion of clinical disease. And this was something that I saw Dr. Rosen actually get a little upset about. He says, well, you should always be suspicious of every disease then. How are you ever going to miss anything? Sometimes that's just not what's going on. So I asked him regarding things like epiglottitis or meningitis or, in this case, brain tumors for vomiting children. How are we supposed to catch stuff like this that we just don't see all the time?
He, of course, was able to wax philosophically and practically and gave us some great tips that I hope you enjoy.
I haven't seen pediatric epiglottitis in decades, and it has made our life a whole lot simpler, because those were really hard kids to intubate. I remember looking in there and seeing nothing but what looked like raw hamburger and pressing on the child's chest so that I could get some bubbles that I could intubate, because you couldn't recognize any anatomy. And these are in the kids that are too small to do a surgical airway on. So, yes, there have been changes in the diseases that we encounter. Supposedly rheumatic fever is making a comeback, but I haven't seen a case of acute rheumatic fever since I was a medical student. And I think it's made a big difference in the valvular cardiac disease that we subsequently have to deal with. So, yeah, I think we're going to see more evolution of diseases that we didn't know anything about, such as new infectious diseases, and evolution of diseases that we never thought existed, such as child abuse, and that we have to learn how to recognize and deal with. I think we go back to a structural basis of emergency medicine that's different from perhaps classical internal medicine or pediatrics. And that is, the specific disease is less important than how deteriorated is the patient. Because you only die in 4 or 5 different ways, even though there's an almost infinite number of diseases that can put you on a path to death. So instead of trying to remember all the rare diseases that you read about in medical school and have never seen in your lifetime, look at the patient and say, is the patient dying? If so, how is he dying? Is it respiratory? Is it pump failure? Is it volume control? Is it oxygen deficit? Is it metabolic? And then, and only then, can you start trying to figure out what it was that put the patient on that pathway. And I think doing it that way helps you not to have to think about a million diseases, some of which may not even exist anymore. Now, for those who are seeing diseases under less temporal pressure, I think that the old saying, when you hear hoofbeats, don't start with zebras, is probably good advice. What are we seeing a lot of? And that changes from month to month, as you well know, in pediatrics. So when you see a kid who's short of breath in February, I would suggest that you don't have to think of the same entities as you do in July. And also, I think the hardest thing in medicine is to differentiate the disease that looks like everything else but is something different. I remember I was running a dispensary in the Army. As a surgeon in the Army, I was supposed to do surgery, but one year they made me commanding officer of a dispensary and I did no surgery. Which actually was excellent training, because I learned that you could take care of patients without cutting on them. But 1 month we were having a flu epidemic, and I must have seen 30 kids that day with runny noses, sore ears, sore throats, low-grade fever, and that was it. And the 31st had a low-borne pneumonia, and I missed it completely. Never even crossed my mind that this was a kid who had something more than that viral URI syndrome that I was seeing so much of. And interestingly enough, if you look at some of the experiments in perceptual psychology, it takes a certain number of positive cases for you to be able to recognize them. There's an experiment where they run a series of red boxes on a conveyor belt, and you're supposed to pick out the green boxes. And if the green boxes don't supply 20% of the total number of boxes, you miss every one. So I think that we have to be more realistic about what doctors can find and what they can't see.
I'm the man, I'm the man, I'm the man. Yes, I am, yes, I am, yes, I am. I'm the man.
Hey guys, it's Allison Peasley-Gauthier. I am a dual-trained graduate from Tucson, Arizona, of emergency medicine and pediatrics, and I'm currently working in Boise, Idaho, where we have 4 community ERs that we work in, ranging from freestanding ERs kind of in the middle of nowhere, seeing about 10,000 patients a year to more base hospitals where the volume's about 40,000 a year, with all resources that you need there. So here are my tips about vomiting and gastroenteritis. Number one, vomiting, like only vomiting, patients worry me. There's always a chance that it could just be too early for other symptoms to start, like the diarrhea. But if they come in with just vomiting and diarrhea hasn't started yet, I usually check a couple things. Firstly, I check a glucose to look for diabetes. I have found new onset DKA in kids coming in with vomiting only by doing this. So I think that's really important. And if I'm not going to get a finger stick and I'm getting a urine because I'm more worried about pyelo and like a little girl, if I see glucosuria, then I'm going to be getting probably labs to look for diabetes on those kids. I always do a full neuro exam to look for brain tumors in kids with just vomiting. I've actually found a peanut brain tumor in a toddler by doing this. And then a full set of vital signs, as a lot of the time kids don't seem to get those blood pressures. So I will request for that. A lot of questions about their history, and a full exam to look for underlying sepsis is a big one that sometimes vomiting only is how they come in. Things like pneumonia can be there, you know, obviously, if they have a GI issue like obstruction. I've actually found like cellulitis and sepsis by doing this. So I think it's really important when they just have the vomiting, the diarrhea hasn't either started yet or it's not going to come because it's not actually gastroenteritis. So once I've decided, okay, this is gastroenteritis, I am a huge fan of ODT Zofran. I wait the 20 minutes until I PO challenge and I start slow. I hand parents actually a syringe. I'll mark it on there how much they need an hour, how much they need as a bolus. And then after they can keep, you know, just like 10 mLs down, I tell family that they can go ahead and increase that amount. I'm a huge fan of oral hydration. I will try that in kids and some simple, you know, teenagers or a 20-year-old adults with vomiting. I have used NG tubes in the past for hydration in kids with Pedialyte. I think it works wonders, and it saves them. Sometimes the stress of the IV start is way worse than the NG placement. So I've also tried the isopropyl alcohol, which is the alcohol swab just under the nose to help with nausea until they can get an IV in and actually get some medicines if they're really sick. I just wanted to touch about things that I look for on their exam that kind of persuade me to go ahead and just put that IV in right away. So this is in typically kids that I'm looking for these things. So I check cap refill to look for perfusion. If it's delayed, I check cap refill on every single peds patient. But if it's delayed in the vomiting and diarrhea kid, then they're going to get an IV because they're pretty behind if we're seeing a true delay in that. Respiratory rate is really important in these kids. You wouldn't always think it is, but I look for a high respiratory rate because that's usually a sign that they're acidotic and they're breathing off that extra acid. I'm one of the fortunate people that can smell ketones. And so if you can smell ketones in a kid, that probably means they're pretty down and they need an IV if you're all at all worried about them. I look at their weight and talk about how much of a weight drop that they've had. Kids that have had a significant weight drop are pretty severely dehydrated and they're going to need an IV. I take to heart the number of wet diapers that parents are telling me. If they're only telling me 1 to 2, but it could have been in with some stool, I probably don't worry as much. But if they're definite, sure, only 1 to 2 urine in a 24-hour period, they're going to get an IV. And obviously mental status. I mean, if they're down and not really interactive and they just look kind of punky, they're probably going to get an IV from me because those are the kids that are not just vomited a few times, diarrhea a few times and running around the room. Those are the kids that are sick. And so I take those things pretty seriously. I always warn parents that diarrhea is going to last longer than the vomiting. Just because I think sometimes they think everything's just going to wrap up magically in 24 hours. And I always warn that sugary drinks like juice will worsen this diarrhea with that sucrose load. So I recommend Pedialyte, and typically parents are going home with a bottle from the ER to try. And a bland diet. You know, we used to actually, when I first started training, recommend the BRAT diet to everybody. And then the studies came out from the AAP that they didn't like the BRAT diet. They wanted, you know, a regular toddler's diet. But unfortunately, these days, you know, a regular toddler's diet sometimes is that Flaming Hot Cheetos bag. So I think you have to kind of remind parents, like, they need to eat a little bit blander food, avoid those Flaming Hot Cheetos so they don't get cheatosis. And, you know, I do recommend things from the BRAT diet, like toast and bananas and applesauce, just to remind them that they need to eat something simpler. For adults, I usually start with Zofran and Benadryl. I like the synergistic effect. I will give Toradol frequently in younger, healthier adults that don't have a slew of medical problems. If I'm going to check labs, I'll check a BMP and pregnancy test. But I don't always check labs. And the only times I really get stool studies, if I think they are higher risk for C. diff, like recent C. diff, recent antibiotics, or if it sounds like a bacterial gastroenteritis, like with high fevers, severe abdominal cramping, and or blood in the stool. Otherwise, I don't check stool studies, and they can follow up with their doctor to get those done if needed. So that's kind of my overall vomiting, gastroenteritis thought process. So full exam, full neuro exam for just vomiting. Huge fan of oral hydration, but there are some cases when you need the IV, and you know, I look for that cap refill, respiratory rate, wet diapers, mental status changes, and then always warning family about how things are going to go. Diarrhea is going to last longer. It's okay, you know, but these are the things to look for, you know, hydration, such as, are they crying with tears? Are they peeing? How is their mental status? And as long as they're maintaining those, then they're doing pretty good. So I hope you guys are all doing well and stay cool this summer. Talk to you guys later. Bye. I like the way you're working. No diggity. I gotta bag it up.